Individuality by Robert Greene Ingersoll. On every hand are the enemies of individuality and mental freedom. Custom meets us at the cradle and leaves us only at the tomb. Our first questions are answered by ignorance and our last by superstition. We are pushed and dragged by countless hands along the beaten track, and our entire training can be summed up in the word suppression. Our desire to have a thing or to do a thing is considered as conclusive evidence that we ought not to have it and ought not to do it. At every turn we run against cherubim and a flaming sword, guarding some entrance to the Eden of our desire. We are allowed to investigate all subjects in which we feel no particular interest, and to express the opinions of the majority with the utmost freedom. We are taught that the liberty of speech should never be carried to the extent of contradicting the dead witnesses of a popular superstition. Society offers continual rewards for self-betrayal, and they are nearly all earned and claimed, and some are paid. We have all read accounts of Christian gentlemen remarking, when about to be hanged, how much better it would have been for them if they had only followed a mother's advice. But after all, how fortunate it is for the world that the maternal advice has not always been followed. How fortunate it is for us all that it is somewhat unnatural for a human being to obey. Universal obedience is universal stagnation. Disobedience is one of the conditions of progress. Select any age of the world and tell me, what would have been the effect of implicit obedience? Suppose the church had had absolute control of the human mind at any time. Would not the words liberty and progress have been blotted from human speech? In defiance of advice, the world has advanced. Suppose the astronomers had controlled the science of astronomy. Suppose the doctors had controlled the science of medicine. Suppose kings had been left to fix the forms of government. Suppose our fathers had taken the advice of Paul, who said, "Be subject to the powers that be, because they are ordained of God." Suppose the church could control the world today, we would go back to chaos and old night. Philosophy would be branded as infamous. Science would again press its pale and thoughtful face against the prison bars, and round the limbs of liberty would climb the bigot's flame. It is a blessed thing that in every age someone has had individuality enough and courage enough to stand by his own convictions. Someone who had the grandeur to say his say. I believe it was Magellan who said, "The church says the earth is flat, but I have seen its shadow on the moon, and I have more confidence even in a shadow than in the church." On the prow of his ship were disobedience, defiance, scorn, and success. The trouble with most people is they bow to what is called authority. They have a certain reverence for the old because it is old. They think a man is better for being dead, especially if he has been dead a long time. They think the fathers of their nation were the greatest and best of all mankind. All these things they implicitly believe because it is popular and patriotic, and because they were told so when they were very small, and remember distinctly of hearing mother read it out of a book. It is hard to overestimate the influence of early training in the direction of superstition. You first teach children that a certain book is true, that it was written by God Himself, that to question its truth is a sin, that to deny it is a crime, and that should they die without believing that book, they will be forever damned without the benefit of clergy. The consequence is that long before they read that book, they believe it to be true. And when they do read it, their minds are wholly unfitted to investigate its claims. They accept it as a matter of course. In this way, the reason is overcome. The sweet instincts of humanity are blotted from the heart, and while reading its infamous pages, even justice throws aside her scales, shrieking for revenge. And charity, with bloody hands, applauds a deed of murder. In this way, we are taught that the revenge of man is the justice of God, that mercy is not the same everywhere. In this way, the deeds of our race have been subverted. In this way, we have made tyrants, bigots, and inquisitors. In this way, the brain of man has become a kind of palimpsest, upon which and over the writings of nature, superstition has scrawled her countless lies. One great trouble is that most teachers are dishonest. They teach us certainties, those things concerning which they entertain doubts. They do not say, "We think this is so," but "We know this is so." They do not appeal to the reason of the pupil, but they command his faith. They keep all doubts to themselves. They do not explain, they assert. All this is infamous. In this way you may make Christians, but you cannot make men. You cannot make women. You can make followers, but no leaders. Disciples, but no Christs. You may promise power, honor, and happiness to all those who will blindly follow, but you cannot keep your promise. A monarch said to a hermit, "Come with me, and I will give you power." "I have all the power that I know how to use," replied the hermit. "Come," said the king, "and I will give you wealth." "I have no wants that money can supply," said the hermit. "I will give you honor," said the monarch. "Ah, honor cannot be given, it must be earned," was the hermit's answer. "Come," said the king, making a last appeal, "and I will give you happiness." "No," said the man of solitude, "there is no happiness without liberty, and he who follows cannot be free." "You shall have liberty too," said the king. "Then I will stay where I am," said the old man. And all the king's courtiers thought the hermit a fool. Now and then, somebody examines, and in spite of all keeps his manhood, and has the courage to follow where his reason leads. Then the pious get together and repeat wise saws, and exchange knowing nods and most prophetic winks. The stupidly wise sit owl-like on the dead limbs of the tree of knowledge, and solemnly hoot. Wealth sneers, and fashion laughs, and respectability passes by on the other side. And scorn points with all her skinny fingers, and all the snakes of superstition writhe and hiss, and slander lends her tongue, and infamy her brand, and perjury her oath, and the law its power, and bigotry tortures, and the church kills. The church hates a thinker precisely for the same reason a robber dislikes a sheriff, or a thief despises a prosecuting witness. Tyranny likes courtiers, flatterers, followers, fawners. And superstition wants believers, disciples, zealots, hypocrites, and subscribers. The church demands worship, the very thing that man should give to no being, human or divine. To worship another is to degrade yourself. Worship is awe and dread and vague fear and blind hope. It is a spirit of worship that elevates the one and degrades the many, that builds palaces for robbers, erects monuments to crime, and forges manacles even for its own hands. The spirit of worship is the spirit of tyranny. The worshiper always regrets that he is not the worshipped. We should all remember that the intellect has no knees, and that whatever the attitude of the body may be, the brave soul is always found erect. Whoever worships abdicates. Whoever believes at the command of power tramples his own individuality beneath his feet, and voluntarily robs himself of all that renders man superior to the brute. The despotism of faith is justified upon the ground that Christian countries are the grandest and most prosperous of the world. At one time, the same thing could have been truly said in India, in Egypt, in Greece, in Rome, and in every other country that has, in the history of the world, swept to empire. Numberless circumstances and countless conditions have produced the prosperity of the Christian world. And the truth is, we have advanced in spite of religious zeal, ignorance, and opposition. The church has won no victories for the rights of man. Luther labored to reform the church, Voltaire to reform men. Over every fortress of tyranny has waved and still waves the banner of the church. Wherever brave blood has been shed, the sword of the church has been wet. On every chain has been the sign of the cross. The altar and throne have leaned against and supported each other. All that is good in our civilization is a result of commerce, climate, soil, geographical position, industry, invention, discovery, art, and science. The church has been the enemy of progress, for the reason that it has endeavored to prevent man thinking for himself. To prevent thought is to prevent all advancement except in the direction of faith. Who can imagine the infinite impudence of a church assuming to think for the human race? Who can imagine the infinite impudence of a church that pretends to be the mouthpiece of God, and in His name threatens to inflict eternal punishment upon those who honestly reject its claims and scorn its pretensions? By what right does man, or an organization of men, or a God, claim to hold a brain in bondage? When a fact can be demonstrated, force is unnecessary. When it cannot be demonstrated, an appeal to force is infamous. In the presence of the unknown, all have an equal right to think. Over the vast plain called life, we are all travelers, and not one traveler is perfectly certain that he is going in the right direction. True it is that no other plane is so well supplied with guideboards. At every turn and crossing you will find them, and upon each one is written the exact direction and distance. One great trouble is, however, that these boards are all different, and the result is that most travelers are confused in proportion to the number they read. Thousands of people are around each of these signs, and each one is doing his best to convince the traveler that his particular board is the only one upon which the least reliance can be placed, and that if his road is taken, the reward for doing so will be infinite and eternal, while all the other roads are said to lead to hell, and all the makers of the other guideboards are declared to be heretics, hypocrites, and liars. "Well," says the traveler, "you may be right in what you say, but allow me at least to read some of the other directions and examine a little into their claims. I wish to rely a little upon my own judgment in a matter of so great importance." "No, sir," shouts the zealot, "that is the very thing you are not allowed to do. You must go my way without investigation, or you're as good as damned already." "Well," says the traveler, "if that is so, I believe I'd better go your way." And so most of them go along, taking the word of those who know as little as themselves. But now and then comes along one who, in spite of all the threats, calmly examines the claims of all and, just as calmly, rejects them all. These travelers take roads of their own and are denounced by all the others as infidels and atheists. Around all these guideboards, as far as the eye can reach, the ground is covered with mountains of human bones, crumbling and bleaching in the rain and sun. They are the bones of martyrs, murdered men and women, fathers and mothers, and babes. In my judgment, every human being should take a road of his own. Every mind should be true to itself, should think, investigate, and conclude for itself. This is a duty alike incumbent upon pauper and prince. Every soul should repel dictation and tyranny, no matter from what source they come, from earth or heaven, from men or gods. Besides, every traveler upon this vast plain should give to every other traveler his best idea as to the road that should be taken. Each is entitled to the honest opinion of all. And there is but one way to get an honest opinion upon any subject whatever. The person giving the opinion must be free from fear. The merchant must not fear to lose his custom, the doctor his practice, nor the preacher his pulpit. There can be no advance without liberty. Suppression of honest inquiry is retrogression, and must end in intellectual night. The tendency of Orthodox religion today is toward mental slavery and barbarism. Not one of the Orthodox ministers dare preach what he thinks if he knows a majority of his congregation think otherwise. He knows that every member of his church stands guard over his brain with a creed like a club in his hand. He knows that he is not expected to search after the truth, but that he is employed to defend the creed. Every pulpit is a pillory in which stands a hired culprit defending the justice of his own imprisonment. Is it desirable that all should be exactly alike in their religious convictions? Is any such thing even possible? Do we not know that there are no two persons alike in the whole world? No two trees, no two leaves, no two anything that are alike? Infinite diversity is the law. Religion tries to force all minds into one mold. Knowing that all cannot believe, the church endeavors to make all say they believe. She longs for the unity of hypocrisy and detests the splendid diversity of individuality and freedom. Nearly all people stand in great horror of annihilation, and yet to give up your individuality is to annihilate yourself. Mental slavery is mental death, and every man who has given up his intellectual freedom is the living coffin of his dead soul. In this sense, every church is a cemetery, and every creed an epitaph. We should all remember that to be like other people is to be unlike ourselves, and that nothing can be more detestable in character than servile imitation. The great trouble with imitation is that we are apt to ape those who are in reality far below us. After all, the poorest bargain that a human being can make is to give his individuality for what is called respectability. There is no saying more degrading than this: it is better to be the tail of a lion than the head of a dog. It is a responsibility to think and act for yourself. Most people hate responsibility. Therefore, they join something and become the tail of some lion. They say, "My party can act for me. My church can do my thinking. It's enough for me to pay taxes and obey the lion to which I belong, without troubling myself about the right, the wrong, or the why, or the wherefore of anything whatever." These people are respectable. They hate reformers and dislike exceedingly to have their minds disturbed. They regard convictions as very disagreeable things to have. They love forms and enjoy beyond everything else telling what a splendid tail their lion has and what a troublesome dog their neighbor is. Besides this natural inclination to avoid personal responsibility is and always has been the fact that every religionist has warned men against the presumption and wickedness of thinking for themselves. Reason has been denounced by all Christendom as the only unsafe guide. The church has left nothing undone to prevent man following the logic of his brain. The plainest facts have been covered with the mantle of mystery. The grossest absurdities have been declared to be self-evident facts. The order of nature has been, as it were, reversed, that the hypocritical few might govern the honest many. The man who stood by the conclusion of his reason was denounced as a scorner and hater of God and his holy church. From the organization of the first church until this moment, to think your own thoughts has been inconsistent with membership. Every member has borne the marks of collar and chain and whip. No man ever seriously attempted to reform a church without being cast out and hunted down by the hounds of hypocrisy. The highest crime against a creed is to change it. Reformation is treason. Thousands of young men are being educated at this moment by the various churches. What for? In order that they may be prepared to investigate the phenomena by which we are surrounded? No. The object, and the only object, is that they may be prepared to defend a creed, that they may learn the arguments of their respective churches and repeat them in the dull ears of a thoughtless congregation. If one, after being thus trained at the expense of the Methodists, turns Presbyterian or Baptist, he is denounced as an ungrateful wretch. Honest investigation is utterly impossible within the pale of any church, for the reason that if you think the church is right, you will not investigate. And if you think it wrong, the church will investigate you. The consequence of this is that most of the theological literature is a result of suppression, of fear, tyranny, and hypocrisy. Every Orthodox writer necessarily said to himself, "If I write that, my wife and children may want for bread. I will be covered with shame and branded with infamy. But if I write this, I will gain position, power, and honor. My church rewards defenders and burns reformers." Under these conditions, all of your Scotts, Henrys, and McKnights have written. And weighed in these scales, what are their commentaries worth? They are not the ideas and decisions of honest judges, but the sophisms of the paid attorneys of superstition. Who can tell what the world has lost by this infamous system of suppression? How many grand thinkers have died with the mailed hand of superstition upon their lips? How many splendid ideas have perished in the cradle of the brain, strangled in the poison coils of that python, the church? For thousands of years, a thinker was hunted down like an escaped convict. To him who braved the church, every door was shut, every knife was open. To shelter him from the wild storm, to give him a crust when dying, to put a cup of water to his cracked and bleeding lips, these were all crimes, not one of which the church ever did forgive. And with the justice taught of her God, his helpless children were exterminated as scorpions and vipers. Who at the present day can imagine the courage, the devotion to principle, the intellectual and moral grandeur at once required to be an infidel? To brave the church, her racks, her faggots, her dungeons, her tongues of fire. To defy and scorn her heaven and her hell, her devil and her God. They were the noblest sons of earth. They were the real saviors of our race, the destroyers of superstition and the creators of science. They were the real titans who bared their grand foreheads to all the thunderbolts of all the gods. The church has been, and still is, the great robber. She has rifled not only the pockets, but the brains of the world. She is the stone at the sepulchre of liberty, the upas tree in whose shade the intellect of man has withered, the gorgon beneath whose gaze the human heart has turned to stone. Under her influence, even the Protestant mother expects to be happy in heaven, while her brave boy, who fell fighting for the rights of man, shall writhe in hell. It is said that some of the Indian tribes place the heads of their children between pieces of bark until the form of the skull is permanently changed. To us, this seems a most shocking custom. And yet, after all, is it as bad as to put the souls of our children in the straitjacket of a creed? To so utterly deform their minds that they regard the God of the Bible as a being of infinite mercy? And really consider it a virtue to believe a thing just because it seems unreasonable? Every child in the Christian world has uttered its wondering protest against this outrage. All the machinery of the church is constantly employed in corrupting the reason of children. In every possible way, they are robbed of their own thoughts and forced to accept the statements of others. Every Sunday school has for its object the crushing out of every germ of individuality. The poor children are taught that nothing can be more acceptable to God than unreasoning obedience and eyeless faith, and that to believe God did an impossible act is far better than to do a good one yourself. They are told that all religions have simply been the John the Baptists of ours, that all the gods of antiquity have withered and shrunken into the Jehovah of the Jews, that all the longings and aspirations of the race are realized in the motto of the Evangelical Alliance, liberty in non-essentials, that all there is or ever was of religion can be found in the Apostles' Creed, that there is nothing left to be discovered, that all the thinkers are dead, and all the living should simply be believers, that we have only to repeat the epitaph found on the grave of wisdom, that graveyards are the best possible universities, and that the children must be forever beaten with the bones of the fathers. It has always seemed absurd to suppose that a God would choose for his companions, during all eternity, the dear souls whose highest and only ambition is to obey. He certainly would now and then be tempted to make the same remark made by an English gentleman to his poor guest. The gentleman had invited a man in humble circumstances to dine with him. The man was so overcome with the honor that to everything the gentleman said, he replied, "Yes." Tired at last with the monotony of acquiescence, the gentleman cried out, "For God's sake, my good man, say no just once, so there will be two of us." Is it possible that an infinite God created this world simply to be the dwelling place of slaves and serfs, simply for the purpose of raising orthodox Christians? That he did a few miracles to astonish them, that all the evils of life are simply his punishments, and that he is finally going to turn heaven into a kind of religious museum filled with Baptist barnacles, petrified Presbyterians, and Methodist mummies? I want no heaven for which I must give my reason, no happiness in exchange for my liberty, and no immortality that demands the surrender of my individuality. Better to rot in the windowless tomb to which there is no door but the red mouth of the pallid worm, than to wear the jeweled collar even of a god.